Welcome back to the Best in Overnight Talk Radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Dave Schrader, and sitting across from me, my producer and co-host of Darkness Radio, Tim Dennis. We got a big weekend here. A lot of stuff going on. I know there's some bad weather sweeping across the United States.
Yes, sir.
Tim, so it's going to keep people from maybe being able to go out and enjoy the weather. So I thought we'd mention, you and I had a chance to see two back-to-back movies this week.
Yes, we did.
Conjuring 2. Mm-hmm. The Enfield Poltergeist case,
yep.
Which is the, I hate to call it a sequel because it's not really a sequel to the first movie. It's its own self-contained story, but it's the next adventure in the Ed and Lorraine story, or Ed and Lorraine Warren story.
Right, right.
So Conjuring 2 takes place in Enfield, England, with the Enfield Poltergeist case. I really like this movie. I don't think it was on par with the first Conjuring movie, which really I thought was a great psychological creeper.
Mm-hmm.
And a great thriller in that sense. But I enjoyed this, and I thought it was fantastic that they tackled the controversy that seemed to follow the Warrens throughout their career. They didn't seem to shy away from it, and I thought, you know, that's a really nice little twist because they could have just made these two these spiritual iconic figures through this movie series. But they attacked him regarding the Amityville case and some of the other cases they dealt with. I thought it was overall a really strong, solid movie with a couple of good scares and some good twists and turns. So I don't know, out of 5 stars, I would easily give this one 4 stars. Where do you come down on it?
I went a little less, and here's why. Although I did like the fact that, like you said, they brought up the doubts about Ed and Lorraine's integrity. We'll put it that
right way.
They also, I think, took them down a notch in not their integrity, but their what's the word I want to use? I'm failing at words this hour at night, but they took them down a notch as far as believability because there was more fear in them in this one than there was in the previous one. You know, I mean,
right.
the demon in this movie is definitely spinoff worthy, which we've heard news stories about the fact that this is going to be a spinoff of this.
Much
demon.
Like they did Annabelle as a spinoff from the first Conjuring movie, this nun demon will be the spinoff for a new one-off movie. I think that's to tie this over till Conjuring 3 comes out.
Yep. But, you know, it was a solid story. I like the story. I didn't find very much at issue with the story. Mm-hmm. It had a nice linear flow to it. It had a few startles and surprises in it, but not a lot of great scares to it. So to me, it fell a little flat from The Conjuring. I thought the first Conjuring was amazing.
Right.
So the second one, the first one I rated 4 out of 5. This one I go 3 out of 5. Still a decent movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's by all means, it's a decent movie and a lot better than what Hollywood's putting out now. But didn't quite measure up the way I thought it would.
See, the one thing you and I disagree about, you don't like that they were more hesitant and fearful in this movie. And I appreciated that aspect of their personality. I liked showing that they were fallible and that they could still be unnerved and uncomfortable doing the work that they were doing.
Well, in that, let me qualify this. That Lorraine Warren in this looked like the helpless female you see in every horror movie. And that's what really got me. Because if you're looking to build up two investigators that are reputable in the field, you don't want the helpless female. And that's, I think, exactly what James Wan did with Lorraine Warren in this.
I think what the problem with that is that they went after, they've mentioned the other cases without actually fleshing them out.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the idea that she has been through hell and back through those cases.
Right.
So she's becoming more and more fragile as these movies are progressing, but they do it in one or two throwaway lines. So I think that's part of, you know, what we're missing. So maybe if we'd seen what she'd gone through, we'd have more understanding for her point.
I'm sure.
And it's interesting. They end The Conjuring talking about, hey, there's this family in Amityville that needs our help. And then they start this one with the end of the Amityville investigation.
Right.
So I thought that was a great little tie-in on it as well. So that's where we stand. You said 3 out of 5. I go 4 out of 5. And the other one that was a reboot, or not a reboot, but a sequel, was Independence Day Resurgence, which just came out this weekend. And it's 20 years later, literally, and in the movie scheme, and they're revisiting the whole idea of the visitors, the evil visitors are coming back, and there's going to be carnage, there's going to be destruction of monuments and everything along that lines. This one fell short for me. I thought it was okay. I just felt it was way too much of a retread of the first movie from start to finish. Literally, the way they take care of the aliens was very much the way they did it in the first movie. So I didn't feel that they brought anything new or interesting enough for me to really be excited. So on this one, I'm going to go, I'm going to go pretty low on a 5. I'm going to give it about a 2.75 stars.
Okay. Well, you know, I was trying to think of the perfect analogy for this movie, and I think I found it. And here it is. You know, when you get a sequel for a movie and everything's got to be bigger and badder, but they forgot the soul of the first one?
Right.
That's exactly what they did with this. That, you know, there was a soul to the first one that made you feel for the characters. And in this one, we get introduced to everybody, and we're supposed to feel for them, but we don't get enough of a backstory, and we're supposed to love the old characters that are in it, but, you know, we're just kind of thrown into it like, love me, you know, like right. They're there and just, you're supposed to love me because I'm the character from the last movie. And in that, you get bigger, badder ships, you get bigger, badder technology, you get bigger, badder this and that, and bigger, badder aliens, but you don't get any meat to the story. And so I would actually be a little harsher than you on this, and I'd say 2 out of 5, and definitely nothing more than a matinee to see it. Yeah.
Well, that's it. So this weekend, if you're looking to get out and see some movies, you could certainly check out both of those, Conjuring 2 in theaters now and Independence Day Resurgence. But that comes with a warning from both of us. Go see the matinee. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Matt Winget as we continue our night of Houdini and Doyle. Conan Doyle in the Mysterious World of Light, 1887 to 1920. When we return, I'm Dave Schrader. This is Coast to Coast AM. Matt Winget started writing in the 1990s as a scriptwriter for the UK TV cop show The Bill, as well as writing national newspaper articles and stories. He's the publisher of a series of Portsmouth, UK-related books and has written stage shows that have been performed around the UK. He's lived and worked in Egypt as an English teacher for the British Council, ran a successful rare book dealership for 10 years, and has worked in publishing, copywriting, and advertising. Tonight we're going to talk about his book, Conan Doyle and the Mysterious World of Light, 1887 to 1920. Matt, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you for getting up early and spending a couple hours with us here this morning. What brought your attention and interest to this aspect of Conan Doyle's life?
Well, I mean, really interesting. You've put, or you've mentioned that I publish local books about Portsmouth over here in the UK. And actually, that's what got me into Conan Doyle. Not many people know that it was in Portsmouth. They always think of Conan Doyle and they think of London and Sherlock Holmes. But it was whilst he was living in Portsmouth in the 1880s that he first came up with the idea of Sherlock Holmes. That was in 1887, whilst he was living just about 500 yards from where I live now. I used to go past where he lived, and I kind of think, wow, that's really fascinating. And as time went by, I just got to know more and more and find out more and more about him. And that's when I discovered that he was also into spiritualism. And I thought, okay, I just want to know more about this. And that's how I got into it.
This is a man that people have talked about as one of the best literature writers out there, created one of the best fictional characters in all of history, obviously, because look, here it is, you know, so many years later, and there's still new iterations and incarnations of Sherlock Holmes that are being introduced. You've got Elementary, a TV series here in the United States on CBS. You've got the very popular Stephen Moffat-driven show Sherlock in the BBC. You've got the very popular series of Sherlock Holmes movies starring Robert Downey Jr. And this character just doesn't seem to go away. One of the most logical and critical thinking characters in the world, and then the author seemed to be open and believed in every whimsical fantasy out there. How do you understand that dichotomy between the kind of characters he created and his own belief in so much of the fantastical?
Well, thank you, Dave. That's all I can say. That is exactly why I wrote the book. I just found it absolutely into it. I thought, how is it that the man who created the most rational being in literature should also be a man who eventually came to believe in fairies? How did that happen? And one of the sort of general myths about Conan Doyle's spiritualism is that he came to it in 1916 during the Great War, or in 1918 after his son's death in the Great War. And actually, that's wrong. It's just completely incorrect. Conan Doyle was into his spiritualism right from the beginning, right from his early days here in Portsmouth. He arrived here in 1882, having completed his medical degree in Edinburgh. And at that point, there's no doubt, he was an out-and-out materialist. He was a complete rationalist. He actually wrote about it, saying, when the candle goes out, the flame is expired, and there's an end of the matter. That's how he saw the soul in the body. That, you know, he didn't believe in continuous life after death and this kind of possibility. But whilst he was living in Portsmouth, he met a man called Major General Alfred Wilkes Drayson. And Drayson introduced him to the ideas of theosophy. He was friends with A.P. Sinnett, who was Madame Blavatsky's right-hand man when she was in India. And he talked with Drayson often. He met A.P. Sinnett. And because he considered Drayson to be an incredibly intelligent man, a genius, he really thought he was, when Drayson put forward the notion that he had spoken with his own deceased brother, then basically Canador had to take that seriously. And that's when he started to do his own investigations and experiments very early on in anything paranormal.
Was he atheistic, since he didn't seem to believe that there was any place that the soul continued on after life?
Yeah, I mean, what happened was he was actually brought up a Roman Catholic as a boy, but he was placed in Stonyhurst College in Lancashire, which was run by Jesuits. And it was during his stay at Stonyhurst College that he began to fall away from the faith. The reason being, he saw all of these Jesuit priests, and they were mean. They were mean-hearted. They were unforgiving. He first encountered the tolly, which was a particular punishment that was used by the Jesuits for misbehaving boys, which was a thick rubber slab with which the boys were beaten if they did anything wrong. And he also heard the priests fulminating against those who had never even heard of Jesus Christ and said that they would go to hell. And he just thought, he was always very fair-minded, and in his center of his being, he thought that was just unfair. Why would someone be consigned to hell if they'd not even been given the chance of salvation? And this, for him, started to flag up huge problems. And by the time he was, I don't know, 12, 13, 14, he was already falling away from any spiritual belief. And this was magnified when he went to Edinburgh University, because this really was the home of the Enlightenment in Britain in the 18th century. And that tradition still continued. There was still a strong Enlightenment view, which was the body was a machine. And so this all came together for him, that when he left medical university, he was indeed very much an atheist. He didn't believe in any of that stuff at all.
Isn't that interesting, right? So, and again, a lot of very logical, hypercritical thinkers do question the belief system and a theology and a God because of those exact points, right? That sometimes the leadership of the church seems to be so misdirected, and you start wondering, how can this be? How can these be the people that are supposed to be teaching the loving word of God and driving people away from that experience? I know during the wars, there was always a rise in the spiritualist movement because so many people lost loved ones. And Doyle, as you mentioned, lost his son. Did it become an obsession for him to try to find a way to communicate with his son?
Yeah, I mean, that was a lot later on. But yes, I think what happened with him when he was older was that people often think that he came out as a spiritualist after his son's death. And it's not true. He really started to respond to what was going on during World War One, halfway through the war, before his son had died. Friends around him had been killed. Family members had been killed. His children's nanny, her name was Lily Lotus Simmons, had also died. And this also affected him. And so he started to look for, when he saw all of this grief, waves of grief going not only across Britain, but across the whole of Europe, he just wanted to find something that would make that make sense. That was the reality of it. And so he looked backwards, and he thought about the Fox sisters and the whole Hydesville rappings that had been going on, the Rochester rappings that had been going on in the 1850s. And he kind of reverse-engineered, he retrofitted the facts and said, well, I believe that happened back then because that was God announcing that this is a new revelation. This is proof at last that there is life after death. We've only ever had to have faith of it before now. But now at last, with spiritualism, we have proof. So, yeah, from there on, he did indeed. I think after his son's death, after Kingsley's death, I think he got more extreme, and it really, really locks him in to that belief system because he needed it on so many different levels, a very, very personal, emotional level as well. Yeah, absolutely.
Was he friends with Houdini prior to his awakening kind of to the spiritualist movement?
No, and this is what's interesting. You mentioned Houdini and Doyle earlier on. And are you referring to the TV show that's been on recently, which came up?
Well, we mentioned that Michael Weston, yeah. the character who plays Houdini, called in and spent a little time with us at the beginning of the show this evening. And of course, the season finale airs this Monday, July 4th on Fox. We were discussing a little bit about that, but there was this friendship, this alliance between Houdini and Doyle.
There was, and I mean, the reason I ask is that if people have been watching Houdini and Doyle, the TV show, it's a great show, it's good fun. It's got very, very little to do with anything.
Right, yeah, and we mentioned that. It's a fictional account of their friendship and making them, putting them in an X-Files style show of making them investigators of supernatural claims along with the first female Scotland Yard detective. So we understand that's more of the entertainment value, but I'm still curious
The reason I say that is that is that Houdini. If you're watching the show, Houdini's around about 1906, somewhere around there. Houdini got to know Conan Doyle after about 1920 in real life. So he was already a convinced spiritualist by this time. They met a long time afterwards. If you see what I mean, a long time after he'd already become spiritualist guy.
Right. And that's what I was curious about, if that was something that happened, because it would almost make more sense that they were friends before that aspect of it instead of rather later. So, we'll get into that friendship and more, I'm sure, as the show progresses here. We've got about a minute and a half left in this segment before we go to break.
Sure.
When you're researching this information, how readily available is there real legitimate information from Conan Doyle about his thoughts and beliefs on this?
Well, this is what's so great, is that the Portsmouth City Council was given a bequest by a guy called Richard Lancelin Green, who was an absolutely amazing collector of everything to do with Conan Doyle. And there is a very strange story about his death, by the way, which maybe we can come back to after the break, because it's quite peculiar. But he gave basically after his
death. I'm sorry, regarding whose death?
Richard Lancelin Green, the guy who bequeathed this huge amount of material to the Portsmouth City Council. After he died, he bequeathed 40,000 documents and 16,000 further artifacts, all of which were related to Conan Doyle. And it's that archive that I got access to have a look at his beliefs. And there is quite a lot of early material about his beliefs in spiritualism and experimentation that he did and all sorts of things like this. So yeah, it's really quite fascinating to get in there. When I was first shown the archive, I was just interested generally about Conan Doyle and I wandered into a room and it was like Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, that scene at the end.
Right.
So I just kind of like picked up the lid off of one box, and there was a copy of this magazine called Light. And Light was a journal for the spiritual, occult, and mystical, for which Conan Doyle used to write. And he was writing right away from the beginning in the 1880s. Yeah.
Let's talk about that and more when we return. Our guest for the remainder of the show, Matt Wingett, will discuss with us Arthur Conan Doyle and the occult here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I am Dave Schrader. And listen, if you're alone this summer, you want to find somebody to go out and explore the wonder that is our planet, then I encourage you to check out George Norrie's ParanormalDate.com. ParanormalDate.com. You could meet your new best friend or the love of your life, and it's just as simple as signing on and getting a free membership. Once you sign on, if you decide you'd like to stand for the full membership, use the summer code SUMMER in order to have deep discount savings and become a full-fledged member. Over 48,000 members on the site now, and we'd like you to be a part of it. Meet people that are like you and interested in the same topics you hear about here on Coast to Coast AM. Go check out coasttocoastam.com for information and updates and the special keywords for paranormaldate.com. And while you're there, check out George Norrie's TV show, Beyond Belief, or you can go directly to beyondbelief.com, because if you like what you hear on Coast to Coast, you'll love what you see and what George shares with you on his television series. Go check it out. You'll find out why he is the best, and this is the best in paranormal talk radio and overnight talk radio. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Matt Wingett continues with Conan Doyle and the occult here on Coast to Coast AM. We're back as we continue our examination into the life of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and his interest and fascination with the supernatural and occult. Matt Wingett, our guest this evening, Conan Doyle and the Mysterious World of Light, 1887 to 1920. That's the book. You can find information, links, and more about that at coasttocoastam.com. Matt, let's talk a little bit more about this. I mean, he was writing for this magazine pretty much from the start, you said, correct? Light?
Yeah, absolutely. What happened was, just living in Portsmouth, as I said, with General Wilkes Grayson's influence, he started to experiment in sorts of psychical and paranormal things. So a friend of his called Henry Ball, he started to do the experiment. Absolutely convinced himself of truth of telepathy. He wrote in his notes that Ball would sit at one end of the room with his back to him. He would sit at the other end of the room. Conan would draw something, and Ball would draw exactly the same thing. And that he repeated that time and time again, and there was no communication. He believed that there was an excretion of thought, as he called it, which was like a radio transmission between the pair of them that somehow meant that they were able to read each other's minds. So that was the starting point. And then Ron, he got into doing seances. He attended a seance with another general, actually, General Hart, who was over in North End in Portsmouth. And he attended his first seance in 1886. And he took notes about that. It wasn't a great seance. He said what happened was that they sat there for hours, and in fact, to get themselves in the mood, they read instructions from Light and then read out a section of the Bible to kind of give it a spiritualistic air. And they sat there for a very long time. Eventually, the pointer started to move, it was a table tapping seance. So what would happen is they would recite letters of the alphabet, and then the table would lift and drop on the most on the letter that was required. And after hours, they finally got a message through, and the message was, "You're going too slowly. How much longer are you going to take?" which isn't the kind of most revealing come from the other side. But he then attended another seance a week later, and this time round, he experienced genuine phenomena, and it's in his notes. The room temperature in the room absolutely plummeted. They got a message through from a guy called Henry Hasty, being one of the women in the room, being his sweetheart. And he said, "Don't mourn for me, I've gone. Just move on and find other people." And at the same time, she was convinced that she could feel a hand, ice cold hand, in her arms, and a presence standing behind her. And Conan Doyle then touched her, and her skin was ice cold. And at the kind of instigation of the spirits, it was asked that the whole thing be stopped. So that was his first kind of real spooky experience. So yeah, things started to go on from there. Even then, though, he wasn't convinced. Even then.
Now, I know his wife believed that she had mediumistic ability. Did she believe it at this point as well, or did that come later on in their lives?
It's interesting, because remember, he had two wives. At this point, he was married to two, otherwise Louise Conan Doyle, who contracted pneumonia. She was interested, and she was she who encouraged him to use his scientific mind to investigate spiritualism. She died in 1906 of, tuberculosis. That's why, not pneumonia. She had tuberculosis. And, she died in 1906. But then Jean Leckie married Conan Doyle. And interesting story with Jean Leckie, because Jean had moved into the house way, way beforehand. with Toohey and Conan Doyle. And Conan Doyle called her his platonic mistress. I'm not even sure what that means. but when Toohey died, it was very, very shortly afterwards that he then married Jean. And Jean did, at first, discourage Conan Doyle from entering into any further psychical investigations, because basically she'd had this rival woman for the last 10 years, and she didn't need Conan Doyle contacting her even after she'd died. She didn't need rivalry from beyond the grave. So she very much discouraged Conan Doyle from his psychic experimentation. However, that changed in World War One when she started to lose her own relatives. And when that started to happen, Malcolm Leckie was probably, which was her brother, I think was probably for her the turning point. And she also then got into spiritualism and did indeed develop mediumistic abilities, yes.
Wow, so he was really kind of surrounding himself with this kind of whole world of spirituality, with the people that he not only was friends with and dealt with, but married. Here is his second wife ends up taking this on as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, and he'd also been, in 1893, he joined the Society for Psychical Research. And, you know, he went and investigated poltergeist phenomena in Devon. So, you know, it was like this, he was continually interested in this. And that's what's so fascinating, is that he also, at the same time, was writing Sherlock Holmes. And I think it's one of the reasons that he actually got so fed up with writing Sherlock Holmes. He hated writing Sherlock Holmes, because I think he'd moved on. I think when he was a young man, you know, in the 1880s, you know, after coming out from university, he was that rationalist man, that materialist man, but he'd moved on. And yet, so Sherlock Holmes was sort of a relic of a previous way of thinking. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the public loved Sherlock Holmes. And so he carried on, he was forced to write him. But, you know, Conan Doyle even said himself, if I'm remembered solely for my invention of Sherlock Holmes, I will regard my life as a failure. Isn't that extraordinary? As a writer myself, I could do with a failure like that.
Yeah, that's a failure anybody would like to be associated with. But I guess that, you know, that's like Adam West, who was forever linked with Batman and Shatner being linked with Kirk, because they were so much more than the one character that they created or helped to evolve. So I guess you get to that point, too. And if there was this love-hate relationship between himself and this character, you know, who a lot of people forget, they don't always portray it in the movies, but he was a deeply flawed character that was addicted to heroin and alcohol and was kind of a broken human being as well. And his intelligence was almost a prison for himself.
Yes, and I've got to say, as an aside, I think that's why the casting of Robert Downey Jr. in those fun movies was actually a piece of it was inspired. Because that's very much Robert Downey Jr.'s story as well. He's a very, very intelligent man who was, you know, who had these fights with addiction all his life. So yeah, I mean, that's just as an aside. But yes, it's a really fascinating character, Sherlock Holmes, and there's so much depth in him. And I think that's really what intrigues people and draws them in. Absolutely.
What do you find when he did his research and going out to look for the claims of poltergeist and ghosts? What was his observations from these cases? Was he able to debunk them pretty easily, or was he usually of the mind that this is exactly what it appears to be? It must be spiritual.
Well, this is interesting. It's a great question, because actually the Devon poltergeist is a really interesting point, because it's pivotal later on in his beliefs, in what he states his beliefs are in spiritualism. And yet there are two very, very different accounts of the investigation. What happened was that he was asked to down. So I'll tell you the kind of later story that he tells in his Memories and Adventures, which is his account of some of his adventures in his life. And basically he says that he was invited down to Charmouth in Devon, visit a house of a Colonel Elmore, who lived in a great big house in the countryside, you know, kind of Hound of the Baskerville type house, which was experiencing these bizarre poltergeist phenomena that he was actually driving Colonel Elmore to leave the house. So Conan Doyle went down with fellow SPR researchers, Sidney Scott and Frank Podmore, and they set up all sorts of strings and threads across the corridors to see if anyone was passing by. They took out cameras, try and film, to try and photograph things. And the first night, nothing happened. The second night, they suddenly heard, about 2 o'clock in the morning, they heard this outrageously loud sound of some banging coming from the kitchen area. Boom, boom, boom. This incredible banging sound. Conan Doyle said it was as if someone were belaboring a table with a cudgel. So they went to investigate, and they checked all the threads. There was no sign of anyone having passed. The kitchen was locked. They opened the kitchen, went in. Nothing there. Nothing to explain this extraordinary noise. Later, about 10 years later, a body was found in the garden and of a baby. And Conan Doyle was convinced that in some way that baby's body had been the cause of this poltergeist activity. So that's the account that he gives later on in life as a part of the justification of his spiritualism. However, there is a contemporary account that he gives to somebody called Jack Payne at the time. And the contemporary account is very, very different. Basically, they do indeed go over to Devon. They go to not a great big shambling house in the countryside, but a small smuggler's cottage where there's a family that's quite concerned by noises that are coming in the middle of the night. So they do indeed stay the first night and nothing happens. On the second night, the son, who is 17 years old, invites them for a whiskey about 12 o'clock or so. They decline. The son then excuses himself and goes out, comes back in, and about half an hour later, there's a banging noise from the kitchen. They go and investigate, and there's nothing there. However, both of them are pretty convinced that this prankster son went out, got a friend of his to bang on the door just to scare them, and carried on their way, and they were completely unconvinced. And interestingly, that account, which he gave to Jack Payne, also is the same account that Frank Podmore gives. So it's corroborated by a second witness. How that story became the first story I told you about this shambling house, I don't know. What I do know is that memory is not simply the replaying of a tape. You know, psychologists have done studies on this now, and they've found that memory is constructed. Every time you remember something, you have to reconstruct it. And I think over the years, as Conan Doyle got older, he just got muddled. He was a man with an extraordinary imagination, and he started to fill in the gaps. And it's a very, very interesting thing that one of the kind of key things that he talks about as the basis of his faith actually probably never happened. And that's really fascinating.
Wow, it is interesting how we can fool our minds into remembering things that never happened or happened in a different way, right? When we're trying to make a point, and somehow that fiction becomes reality to us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I can think of times myself where I've been absolutely convinced that somebody had like a blue jumper on, or they were wearing this or whatever, and then I'm shown the photograph, and it's like, oh, okay, I got that completely wrong. I mean, you know, it's really fascinating. So, you know, Conan Doyle, he was a brilliant man. There's no getting around it, but he was not immune to making mistakes from time to time.
With that said, let's talk about another one that, with about the last 4 minutes we have left in this segment, one of the more popular and widespread stories that kind of threw egg into his face later was the Cottingley Fairies.
Right.
And this is something that he actually did investigate with Harry Houdini, correct?
I think it was Harry Price that he did that with. It was Harry Price and William Hope were the two investigators, but I'm not sure because my research hasn't gone that far. So I've done basic research on this and not complete research. So what I'm going to speak, what I'm going to tell you is, you know, is off the top of my head or is half remembered, but I don't remember being Houdini. But you may be right. So, you know, I stand corrected on that.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the things that started to cause a rift between them because Doyle was so willing to jump on the fairy bandwagon, and Houdini thought he was making kind of a complete ass out of himself by doing this.
I think that's probably right. If I look at the flow of the relationship, yes,
right.
I think you're absolutely right on that one. Yeah.
And they had they had a close friendship, but it jumped back and forth. But it, with Cottingley Fairies, with that story, I mean, here was these two little girls claiming that they were photographing real fairies.
Yeah. Now, look, it's quite interesting, this. People are very unforgiving of Conan Doyle for this because they don't really understand the way that he was thinking. And you need to go back a little bit. When he was traveling through Europe in the 1890s, he had an extraordinary experience happen where he'd been through Switzerland, and he'd seen this amazing pass, this snow-filled pass with this hotel in it. And on his way through France, as he was heading back to England, he decided that he would write a story in which a load of people were stranded in this snowbound hotel, and then one by one they started to get killed. And he thought, this is a great idea, this is going to make a great story. On his way back, he picked up a collection of stories by a writer, Guy de Maupassant, in France. And he started reading the story, and he said, oh my goodness, there was the story I was about to write. Guy de Maupassant, in exactly the same hotel, in exactly the same pass in Switzerland, and I was just about to write it. If I'd written that story, I would have wrecked my reputation and been accused of plagiarism. So he believed that this was divine intervention, that God had sent him that book in order to make sure that he didn't wreck his reputation. So he believed in what some people would just call coincidence. He believed that there was divine intervention, that there was meaning. And the same thing happened with Cottingley Fairies, which was that he had just written an article, literally just finished writing an article for the Strand magazine about how young children see nature spirits and fairies, and that's something which is reported across the world. And exactly at the moment that he finished, a telegram arrived from Felicia Scatcherd, who was the editor of The Two Worlds, another psychic magazine, saying, by the way, did you know that there are a couple of girls who have photographed fairies? And he believed that that was God telling him, or you know, the divine power, whatever you might want to call it, telling him this was true. He thought it was too much of a coincidence to be anything other than true, you know, than something that was being pointed out to him as providence. So he was already, you know, sort of minded to believe in it. And that, I think, colored his judgment all the way through his investigations into the Cottingley Fairies. Yeah, quite strange.
Well, and that gives a little bit more insight onto why he would have been so fascinated by that story. For those of you looking, again, for something fun to do, I think you can find it on YouTube for $2.99. It might be on Netflix, but there was a movie called Fairy Tale, A True Story. And it had Paul McGann. I think Harvey Keitel played Harry Houdini. Peter O'Toole was Arthur Conan Doyle in the movie. And it's kind of the story of them investigating these claims. And it was a great little movie. If you haven't had a chance to check it out, I always like to throw out new suggestions to people. But check that out. It came out in the, I think, late 90s and is kind of a neat little representation of that whole story. We're going to take a break here. We're up against the top of the hour. I don't want to launch into another set of the questions. But when we come back, let's continue. Now, you mentioned a fascinating and interesting death associated with the information you were able to obtain for this book. Let's cover that and continue on discussing the life of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, his interests and fascination in the occult and the supernatural. And when, in the height of all of this, when he was involved, did he ever begin to doubt himself? Did he ever begin to doubt his own thoughts and research? We'll talk to our guest, Matt Winget, about that when we return. I'm Dave Schrader, and you're listening to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM.